Welcome to the monthly podcast, On the Beat, for Circulation, Arrhythmia, and Electrophysiology. I'm Dr. Paul Wong, Editor-in-Chief, with some of the key highlights from this month's issue. In our first paper, Vivek Reddy and Associates studied a novel 7.5 French lattice tip catheter with the compressible 9mm nitinol tip that is able to deliver either focal radio frequency ablation, RFA, or pulsed field ablation, PFA, 2 to 5 second lesions. In a 3-center single-arm first-in-human trial, the catheter was used with a custom mapping system to treat paroxysmal or persistent atrial fibrillation, toggling between energy sources, point-by-point pulmonary vein, or PV encirclement, was performed using biphasic pulsed field ablation posteriorly and either temperature-controlled irrigated RFA or pulse field ablation anteriorly, RF and pulse field PF, or pulse field and pulse field respectively. Linear lesions were created with either PFA or RFA. The 76-patient cohort included 55 paroxysmal and 21 persistent atrial fibrillation or AF patients undergoing either RF-PF pulse field ablation, 40 patients, or PF ablation in 36 patients. Pulmonary vein isolation therapy duration was 22.6 minutes per patient with a mean of 50.1 RF or pulse field ablation lesions per patient. Linear lesions included 14 mitral, 34 left atrial roof, and 44 cavo-tricuspid isthmus lines, with therapy duration times of 5.1, 1.8, and 2.4 minutes per patient, respectively. All lesion sets were acutely successful using 4.7 minutes of fluoroscopy. There were no device-related complications, including no strokes. Post-procedure, esophagogastroduodenoscopy revealed minor mucosal thermal injury in 2 of the 36 RF-PF and 0 of the 24 PF-PF patients. Post-procedure brain MRI revealed DWI positive flare negative and DWI positive flare positive asymptomatic lesions in 5 and 3 of the 51 patients respectively. In our next paper, Moussa Saleh and Associates examined whether chloroquine, hydroxychloroquine plus or minus azithromycin lead to a prolongation of the QT interval, possibly increasing the risk of torsade de pointe and sudden death in a hospitalized population of patients with COVID-19. 201 patients were treated for COVID-19 with chloroquine or hydroxychloroquine. 10 patients or 5% received chloroquine and 191 or 95% received hydroxychloroquine, and 119 or 59% also received azithromycin. The primary outcome of torsade de pointe was not observed in the entire population. Baseline QTC interval did not differ between patients treated with chloroquine or hydroxychloroquine monotherapy versus those treated with combination group chloroquine, hydroxychloroquine, and azithromycin, 440 milliseconds versus 439.9 milliseconds. The maximum QT during treatment was significantly longer in the combination versus the monotherapy group, 470 milliseconds versus 453 milliseconds, p equals 0.004. 7 patients, or 3.5%, required discontinuation of these medications due to QTC prolongation. No arrhythmic deaths were reported. In our next paper, Miko Tulpo and Associates examined whether there's an association between leisure time physical activity and the risk of sudden death and non-sudden cardiac death in coronary artery disease patients. 1,946 patients with angiographically verified coronary disease were classified into 4 groups: inactive, irregularly active, active, exercise irregularly 2 to 3 times per week, and highly active, exercise 4 times or more weekly. During follow-up, median 6.3 years, 52 sudden cardiac death and 49 non-sudden cardiac deaths occurred. Inactive patients had increased risk for sudden cardiac death compared to active patients, hazard ratio 2.45. Leisure time was not associated with sudden cardiac death in patients with Canadian cardiovascular class 1, 18 events in 1,107 patients. among patients with Canadian Cardiovascular Society Class 2 or higher, 34 events in 839 patients. An increased risk for sudden cardiac death encountered in highly active patients, hazard ratio 7.46, p less than 0.001. In inactive patients, hazard ratio 3.64 as compared to active patients. A linear association was observed between leisure time physical activity and non-sudden cardiac death. Those with high leisure time physical activity had the lowest risk for non-sudden cardiac death. In our next paper, Jacob Carruth and Associates examined the preclinical feasibility and safety of a 9mm lattice tip catheter with focal biphasic pulse field, PF-based thoracic vein isolation and linear ablation, combined focal biphasic pulse field and radiofrequency RF focal ablation, and focal biphasic pulse field delivered directly on top of the esophagus. They treated two cohorts of six swine with pulse fields at low dose and high dose, followed for 4 weeks and 2 weeks respectively, to isolate 25 thoracic veins and to create 5 right atrial low-dose pulse field, 6 mitral high-dose pulse field, and 6 roof lines with combined RF and high-dose pulse field. Baseline and follow-up voltage mapping, venous potentials, ostial diameters, and phrenic nerve viability were assessed. High-dose pulse field and RF lesions were delivered in 4 and 1 swine from the inferior vena cava onto a forcefully deviated esophagus. 100% of thoracic veins, 25 out of 25, were successfully isolated with 12.4 applications per vein with a mean pulse field times of less than 90 seconds per vein. Durable isolation improved from 61.5% in the low-dose pulse field to 100% with the high-dose pulse field, P equals 0.04. And all linear lesions were successfully completed without incurring venous stenoses or phrenic injury. High-dose pulse field sections had higher transmurality rates than low-dose pulse field, 98.3% versus 88.1%, p equals 0.03, despite greater thickness, 2.5 versus 1.3 millimeters. Pulse field lesions demonstrated homogeneous fibrosis without epicardial fat, nerve, or vessel involvement. In comparison, combined RF plus high-dose pulse field sections revealed similar transmurality, but expectedly more necrosis, inflammation, and epicardial fat, nerve, and vessel involvement. Significant ablation-related esophageal necrosis, inflammation, and fibrosis were seen in all RF sections as compared to no pulse field sections. In our next paper, Haigai Yavin and Associates investigated the effects of a novel lattice tip catheter designed for focal radiofrequency ablation, RFA, or pulse field ablation in 25 swine. In 14 animals, they examined in step 1, N equals 14, the feasibility to create atrial line of block and described its acute effects on the phrenic nerve and esophagus. In step 2, N equals 7, they examined the subacute effects of pulse field ablation on block durability, phrenic nerve, and esophagus 2 or more weeks. In 4 animals, in step 3, they compared the effects of pulse field ablation and RFA on the esophagus using a mechanical deviation model approximating the esophagus to the right atrium in 4 and direct ablation on its lumen in 4. The effects of endocardial PFA and RFA on the phrenic nerve were also compared in N equals 10. Histological analysis were performed. Pulse field ablation produced acute block in 100% of lines achieved with 2.1 applications per centimeter line. Histological analysis following a mean of 35 days showed 100% transmurality, thickness range 0.4 to 3.4 millimeters, with a lesion width of 19.4 millimeters. Pulse field ablation selectively affected cardiomyocytes, but spared blood vessels and nervous tissue. Pulse field ablation applied from the posterior atrium to the approximated esophagus produced transmural lesions without esophageal injury. Pulse field ablation applied within the esophageal lumen produced mild edema compared to radiofrequency ablation, 13 applications, which produced epithelial ulcerations. Pulse field ablation resulted in no or transient stunning of the phrenic nerve, less than 5 minutes, without histological changes, while radiofrequency ablation produced paralysis. In our next paper, Gilad Anter and Associates investigated the optimal methods to identify arrhythmogenic substrate of scar-related VT. They examined how often sites of activation slowing during sinus rhythm co-localize with ventricular tachycardia or VT circuit. In a multi-center study in patients with infarct-related VT, the left ventricle was mapped during activation from three directions, sinus rhythm or atrial pacing, right ventricular, and left ventricular LV pacing at 600 milliseconds. Ablation was applied selectively to the cumulative area of slow activation, defined as a sum of all regions with activation time of 40 milliseconds or greater per 10 millimeters. Hemodynamically tolerated ventricular tachycardias or VT were mapped with activation or entrainment. The primary outcome was a composite of appropriate ICE therapies and cardiovascular death. In 85 patients, the left ventricle was mapped during activation from 2.4 directions. The direction of LV activation influenced the location and magnitude of activation slowing. The spatial overlap of activation slowing between sinus rhythm and right ventricular RV pacing was 84.2%. Between sinus rhythm and LV pacing was 61.4%, and between right ventricular and left ventricular pacing, 71.3%. P less than 0.05 between all comparisons. Mapping during sinus rhythm identified only 66.2% of the entire area of activation slowing and 58% of critical isthmus sites. Activation from other directions, right ventricular and left ventricular stimulation, unmasked an additional 33% of slowly conducting zones and 25% critical isthmus sites. The area of maximal activation slowing often corresponded to the site where the wavefront first interacted with the infarct. During a follow-up period of 3.6 years, the primary endpoint occurred in 14 out of 85, or 16.5% of patients. The Larson concluded that the spatial distribution of activation slowing is dependent on the direction of LV activation, with the area of maximal slowing corresponding to the site where the wavefront first interacts with the infarct. In our next paper, Georg Gusek and Associates identified a novel form of abnormal calcium wave activity in normal and failing dog atrial myocytes, which occurs during the action potential and is absent during diastole. The goal of the study was to determine if triggered calcium waves affect cellular electrophysiological properties. The authors used simultaneous recordings of intracellular calcium and action potentials for the measurement of maximal diastolic potential and action potential duration during triggered calcium waves in isolated dog atrial myocytes. Computer simulations then explored electrophysiological behavior arising from triggered calcium waves at the tissue scale. At 3.3 to 5 Hz, triggered calcium waves occurred during the action potential and outlasted several action potential cycles. Maximum diastolic potential was reduced, and action potential duration was significantly prolonged during triggered calcium waves. All electrophysiological responses to triggered calcium waves were abolished by using SEA0400 and ORM10103, indicating that sodium-calcium exchange current caused depolarization. The time constant recovery from inactivation of calcium current was 40 to 70 milliseconds in atrial myocytes, depending on the holding potential. This current could be responsible for action potential activation during repolarization induced by triggered waves. Modeling studies demonstrate the characteristic properties of triggered calcium waves are potentially arrhythmogenic by promoting both conduction block and reentry arising from the repolarization induced by triggered calcium waves. The authors concluded that triggered calcium waves activate inward sodium-calcium exchange and dramatically reduce atrial maximum diastolic potential and prolong action potential duration, establishing the substrate for reentry that could contribute to initiation and maintenance of atrial arrhythmias. In our next paper, Faisal Merchant and Oman Sayadi and Associates evaluated the ability of a real-time closed-loop system to record and analyze repolarization alternans from multiple intracardiac leads and deliver dynamically ROA-triggered pacing stimuli during the absolute refractory period. They examined the ability of the system to control repolarization alternans and reduce arrhythmia susceptibility in vivo. ROA-triggered pacing can induce repolarization alternans, the magnitude of which can be modulated by varying the amplitude, pulse width, or size of the pacing vector. Using a swine model, N equals 9, the authors demonstrated that to induce 1 microvolt change in the alternans voltage on the body surface, coronary sinus, or left ventricle, requires a delivered charge of 0.04, 0.05, and 0.06 microcoulombs respectively, while to induce one unit change of the K-score requires a delivered charge of 0.93, 0.32, and 0.33 microcoulombs respectively. For all body surface and intracardiac leads, a delta alternans voltage and delta K-score between baseline and R-wave triggered pace beats increases consistently with an increase in the pacing, pulse amplitude, pulse width, and vector spacing. Additionally, the author showed that the proposed method can be used to suppress spontaneously occurring alternans, N equals 7, in the presence of myocardial ischemia. Suppression of repolarization alternans by pacing during the absolute refractory period results in a significant reduction in arrhythmia susceptibility, evidenced by lower S-rank score during programmed ventricular stimulation compared to baseline prior to ischemia. In a perspective outlining the cardiovascular effects of chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine, Ohad Oren and associates described their belief that the use of chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine in COVID-19 should be limited to randomized controlled trials. For critically ill patients unable to enroll in a trial, selective in-hospital use could be considered with careful clinical monitoring in keeping with the FDA's emergency use authorization. The author suggested that studies evaluating chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine should systematically collect baseline demographic data, results from electrocardiographic and echocardiographic monitoring prior to and during treatment, and rates of adverse cardiovascular events in both the near and long term. In a research letter, Federico Migliore and Alexandro Zorzi and associates found a 28% decrease in the number of urgent pacemaker implantations during the 6 weeks after the first COVID-19 case, from 122 to 88, p equals 0.02, compared to the 6 weeks before the first COVID-19 case. The proportion of female patients requiring urgent pacemaker implantation after the COVID-19 outbreak decreased from 6 out of 122, or 49%, to 30 out of 88, or 34%, p equals 0.03. In a special report, Stephanie Kochav and associates described 4 cases of cardiac arrhythmias in COVID-19, including AV block, atrial fibrillation, polymorphic ventricular tachycardia, and pulseless electrical activity arrest. In a year in review, Suraj Kappa and associates discuss a number of the many advances in our understanding of arrhythmia mechanisms, diagnosis, and new therapies in the past year. Data suggests that secretinurin may be a marker for patients at risk of ventricular arrhythmias, while natriuretic peptide receptor C may have a role in atrial fibrosis, and atrial-specific 2-PORT potassium channel task 1 may be a therapeutic target for atrial fibrillation. Sensory neurons may play a key role in sleep apnea related atrial fibrillation. Bariatric surgery is associated with improved atrial fibrillation outcome. Artificial intelligence applied to electrocardiography has yielded estimates of age, gender, and overall health. We have seen new tools for collection of patient-centered outcomes following catheter ablation. There has been significant advances in the ability to identify ventricular tachycardia termination sites through high-density mapping of deceleration zones. We've learned that right ventricular dysfunction may be a predictor of survival benefit after ICD implantation in non-ischemic cardiomyopathy patients. We've seen further insights in the role of his-bundle pacing on improving outcomes. As our understanding of cardiac laminopathies advance, we have new tools to predict arrhythmic event rates in gene carriers. And finally, we've seen numerous advances in the treatment of arrhythmias in patients with congenital heart disease. That's it for this month. We hope that you'll find the journal to be the go-to place for everyone interested in the field. See you next time. This program is copyright American Heart Association 2020.